form a metric space with respect to with this distance. And I claim that actually this, I mean, maybe I should mention it's even a complete metric space, and that WP metrizes so basically it metrizes weak convergence. So let's say against continuous functions vanishing at infinity plus plus the moments of order p converge. Something like this. There are a couple of different ways to state this, and another one is that phi can grow a little bit at infinity, but not faster than the pth power of x. But what I am not actually that interested in the topology at the moment. What I am interested in is the geometry of this metric space. So in fact, I claim that there are natural geodesics in this metric space, and so. A metric space MD is called various things. Maybe some people call it a length space. And some people, I've heard it called a length space, or I've also heard it called a geodesic space, or I've heard it called a path metric space. But anyhow, the notion is that for every pair of points in M, there should be a curve in M such that sigma naught, sigma of 0 equals sigma naught, sigma of 0 equals x naught, sigma of 1 equals x1, and the distance between them, between sigma f and sigma t equals f minus t times the distance between sigma naught and sigma 1. And the claim is that all of these spaces up here are in fact geodesic spaces. Such a curve sigma is called an affinely parameterized, which I will suppress, minimizing geodesic segment. And I will often simply call it a geodesic, but this is really what I mean. And I guess that I'm going to probably focus largely on the case p equals 2. Although, I guess this, almost everything goes through for general p as well. And so I want to construct the geodesics and check that I have all of them, and somehow these generalized straight lines in Rn. And so the existence of geodesics basically follows from the existence of a minimizer in the infimum problem. Given mu and nu, and consider the map that this map gives us this property here. So I want to look at the projection of this optimal measure gamma under this sort of combination of the initial and final point. And of course, when s equals 0, the projection is mu, and when s equals 1, the projection is nu, and in between, I get something in between. And I claim that something like this. And so I guess there are two parts of this. One is an inequality. There are sort of two inequalities, right? That this is less than or equal to this, and that this is greater than or equal to this. And suddenly, slightly. Okay. I've departed from my notes slightly. I would like to come back to my notes. An equivalent definition is that that these two conditions are verified, and maybe that's what I will work with. Right, and the point is that I can never hope to do better than this because of the triangle inequality, that I always have notice that the distance between sigma naught and sigma t plus the distance between sigma t and sigma 1 is always bigger than or equal to the distance between sigma naught and sigma 1. And so if I can show that this distance is actually less than or equal to that, and that this distance is actually less than or equal to this, then I get equality in the triangle inequality, and I can't do any better than that. And then I'm going to actually prove this, and then I'm going to conclude that I must have equality here. And for this thing, I'm in a great position to proceed because I have that W2 is defined as an infimum. Maybe I put the squares in. And I have a candidate for the infimum that defines W2, namely a natural candidate is that notice pi s tensor pi t pushes forward gamma belongs to this set here. So I need this mapping. And then the change of variables tells me that this is equal to pi s of xy minus pi t of xy d gamma xy. So that's something like one minus s x plus s y minus one minus t x plus t y. So the ones go out, and I get s minus, I get t minus s times x minus y. And this is equal to absolute t minus s squared integral of x minus y squared d gamma, which is, because gamma was the minimizer, this thing here is mu nu, rho naught, rho one, whatever we called it. I should put brackets here somewhere. Thank you. Hello? And I have this desired estimate for every S and T. In particular, I have W2 of rho naught rho S plus W2 of rho s rho t plus W2 of rho t rho 1 is less than or equal to W2 of rho naught rho 1 if 0 is less than s is less than t is less than 1. So I know the signs of these terms. And so that tells me that I have the triangle inequality gives me the opposite thing. So the triangle inequality implies equality throughout. And particularly here. So this is what the geodesics look like. At least this is one family of geodesics, and in fact, I claim that this is all families of geodesics. as long as this P is strictly bigger than 1. So as long as I have some strict convexity here, I claim every geodesic has to come from this construction. Max? Right, so this is the mapping from, this guy here is the mapping from Rn cross Rn to Rn cross Rn, which takes xy to pi f of x, pi t of y. Other questions? Thank you. Indeed. So somehow, conversely, so what I can say about uniqueness is that there exists a minimizer. How should I say it? There exists a gamma which minimizes integral x minus y squared. US is actually given by the projection of this gamma under pi s. And this is not hard to prove. So I'm a little bit cavalier because I haven't been careful throughout to assume that the distances between the endpoints are finite. So I guess I should say so for this guy, I'm given U naught, U s, and U 1. And I want to let let gamma 0, 1, or rather let gamma 1, 2 optimally correlate, in other words, be the minimizer between U naught and UF. And let gamma 2, 3 optimally correlate US and U1. Right, so this is in U0 US. This is in US and U1. And then we have a little lemma that says the gluing lemma or something, there exists a gamma 1, 2, 3 that has on Rn cross Rn cross Rn, whose projection onto the first two copies of Rn is this thing, and whose projection onto the second two copies of Rn is this thing, because the right marginal of this measure coincides with the left marginal of that measure. So by the gluing lemma. And it follows from that implies that the projection 1, 3 up gamma 1, 2, 3 actually has this fellow and that fellow as its left and right marginals. And the claim is that being a geodesic actually forces this fellow here to attain a minimum, and moreover forces this US here to be the projection under capital pi S of this gamma 1, 3. So I claim somehow what's going on here is what's at the bottom of this is Jensen's, is some very simple Jensen's inequality for convex functions. So I want to use these two facts here in the following way. I know that d squared of u naught us over s plus d squared of us u1 over 1 minus s from these two formulas is equal to 1 minus s plus s of d squared u naught u1, and I see that I've somehow switched from I've switched from w2 to d. So and I have good expressions for everything. On the one hand, I know I chose optimally correlating measures here and here. So I know that the left-hand side is equal to 1 over s times the integral plus 1 over 1 minus s times the integral of y minus z squared d gamma 2, 3 yz. And I know that the right-hand side is, since this is a candidate for the minimization that defines this guy here, this is less than or equal to integral x minus z squared d gamma 1, 3. And because of these marginal properties of gamma 1, 2, 3, I can add an extra variable of integration that doesn't cost me anything here and here and here. I have this inequality. And what's the most useful way to write this? I guess I bring the S inside. And the 1 minus S inside. And now I have an integral of a convex combination probably should have brought it all over to this side. So I probably have actually 0 is less than x minus z squared minus that stuff, minus s x minus y squared over s minus 1 minus s y minus z squared over 1 minus s d gamma 1, 2, 3. And the point is I'm integrating against a non-negative measure. And the integrand here is non-positive, I hope, by convexity of the square. On the other hand, convex function, so it's less than f times x minus y over x squared plus 1 minus f times y minus z over 1 minus f squared. And this equality is strict unless, because the quadratic function is strictly convex, unless x minus y over s is equal to y minus z over s over 1 minus f. If s is strictly between 0 and 1. And so the integrand here is non-positive. I'm integrating against something positive. The fact that I get an inequality tells me I must have 0 almost everywhere. And so therefore I conclude that this has to be true for almost every x, y, and z in gamma 1, 2, 3. And moreover, that I have an equality here. Which says that in particular equality holds here, which in particular says that gamma 1, 3 is a minimizer for this thing here. So this one I just checked. But equalities hold throughout. And I still have to check this thing. And I claim that this ought to follow from here somehow. Right, and this actually, if this is equal to that almost everywhere, then it also equals x minus z almost everywhere. So that imply these three inequalities here, or two inequalities, say that therefore y is equal to 1 minus fx plus fz gamma 1, 2, 3, almost all x, y, and z. Because, right. because the line connecting from x to y is parallel to the line connecting xz, which is also parallel to the line connecting yz. And so if I, therefore, if I integrate any test function of y against gamma 1, 2, 3, x, y, and z, which is the same as integrating against the test function against u naught f, us rather. Then that's the same thing as integral of c of 1 minus fx plus fz g gamma 1, 2, 3 of x, y, z. But no y appears in the integrand now, and so I can erase this and write gamma 1, 3. And that's that's the integral of the same test function against here. And so this is the last thing. So somehow geodesics are unique, and they're uniquely connected to the optimal measures in this problem here. And so in situations where this infimum has a unique minimizer, for example, if either of the endpoints, mu or nu, are absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue, then this infimum has a unique minimizer, and then the geodesic connecting that to anything else will be unique as well. So the first corollary is that if min well, I shouldn't say it that way. I should say if mu is absolute mu with respect to Lebesgue, for example, so that mu nu is always uniquely attained by some gamma, then the affinely parametrized minimizing geodesic the equivalence relation, probably I don't want to say that. I think, yeah, this is fine. So the equivalence relation subdivides into path-connected components. And what people usually look at is the connected component containing a Dirac mass. Any two Dirac masses are a finite distance from each other. And oh, so the third quality that I'm really interested in is I would really like to have a representation formula for what the geodesic looks like between these two things. I'm going to try to represent everything in terms of densities with respect to Lebesgue measure, as long as I have one of the measures absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue. And so the third quality that's interesting from that point of view is that if mu is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue, us. Let me say if u naught is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue, and us is a minimizing geodesic. And u sub s is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue for all s strictly less than 1. And this guy really comes from, this is the first time we're actually going to use the structure of what we know about the minimizing measures gamma up there. And somehow this fact is related to the fact that if I thought about these densities, which depend on this sort of artificial time parameter S, as being represented by particles which move through space, and I tried to give Lagrangian trajectories, if I tried to say which path all the particles had moved under, this kind of fact here, this formula for pi S, is telling me that every particle is following a straight line. And this thing here is a reflection, is a partial reflection of the fact that these straight lines are not crossing each other, so there are no shocks happening in this time evolution from the PDE point of view. And anyhow, the proof is quite simple. Once you have a representation formula in terms of a gradient convex for gamma, so we know there exists a unique gamma connecting u naught to u1, minimizing, I should have said argument, right? And moreover, and there exists phi convex such that I have this representation of the optimal measure, and that means that I can view US, which is pi s push forward, this gamma can also be viewed as pi s composed with identity cross grad psi push forward u naught. And so what in sort of Lagrangian coordinates, what I have going on is a linear interpolation between the identity map and this gradient convex. And at each time S, I use that to push forward u naught. And so let me call this mapping here f of S. And so the picture is somehow that if u0 is quite diffuse and u1 is rather concentrated, then f of s may be f of 1, may be pushing things very close together. And conversely, if u1 has a part which is diffuse and u0 has a part which is rather concentrated, then F(1) must have may spread things apart somewhere else. These are supposed to be straight lines. They don't look very straight. But my claim is that, so you can't hope for a Lipschitz bound on, I mean, the mapping may not be smooth, it may not be continuous. Under these hypotheses, it may not be much of anything. But the claim is that if you don't go all the way to the end, if you only go partway, then you can't have collapsed any set too much. So for some set x here, fs of x can't be too much smaller. Sorry, fs of x. If s is strictly less than 1. It doesn't get really small until s is equal to 1. And so, in fact, the claim is that fs inverse is 1 over 1 minus f Lipschitz. So if I take any set down here and I look at its pre-image, under fs it can't be bigger than the original set except by this factor raised to the nth power, the volume of it. Because if xy are in Rn, and I look at fsx minus fsy squared, this is 1 minus f x minus y plus s grad phi x minus grad phi y squared. And this is where our Lipschitz estimate is going to come from. And this is positive. And this, because psi is convex, this is positive by not monotonicity. And so so I get an inequality by convexity of psi. And this also tells me that it tells me that the particle trajectories are not crossing each other. So if x is not initially equal to y, then it also, f of s can't equal s of y after any time s less than 1. And particle paths. X not equal y implies fx is not equal to y. So this is, in some sense, some no-crossing property, no shock condition, no shock. So, and I claim that this was relevant to the absolute continuity of this fellow here. So, if I have some set Z of zero Lebesgue measure, well, actually, what's generally true is that, what am I trying to say? The volume of FS inverse of any set Z would be less than or equal to 1 volume of Z. And in particular, so but what our definition is saying, this definition here, is that the integral over Z of UF is equal to the integral over F Z inverse Z of U naught. And so whenever z is Lebesgue measure 0, this is Lebesgue volume 0, and so this is equal to 0. And so that's one way of expressing the fact that U.S. is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue measure, and therefore given by a... So therefore, U.S. is given by a density with respect to Hn by the Radon-Nikodyne theorem. And I will often abuse notation and write this density US of X. So somehow what I have this awful notation, it's this awful hybrid notation. So this is my bad notation. So I think of these two objects as being different. This guy's a measure and that guy's a density with respect to Lebesgue. And moreover, so I'm now in this position to give this representation formula, which is so if you believe that this was actually true. If one X is a Lebesgue point, for U naught, two X is a point where psi is twice differentiable in the sense of Alexandrov. And 3, what am I trying to say? What I really want to say is that d2 psi of x is invertible. And I claim that this actually, this is equivalent to d2 psi to grad psi of x being in the domain of the conjugate function. And so as long as I have both of these measures absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue, this will happen almost everywhere with respect to this measure, which means this happens almost everywhere with respect to that measure. U-notch measure. Then you get all the same, you get these three conditions will also be true for the convex function, which is given by same conditions. for 1 minus f squared over 2 plus f psi x. And this is the convex function whose gradient gives the map fs. And so, so the same equation is going to hold with the 1 replaced by the f, namely, And moreover, this tells us everything that we need to know about U.S. And so, for example, if I want to integrate some function of U.S. I'm free to first do the change of variables FF and then replace this thing here by the ratio of this over this, and I should now replace the integral by the set capital X, where these three conditions hold. And I should have called this Z or something. And somehow I'm doing a bunch of things that aren't really justified, but I'm telling you that the equality between the first thing and the last thing is actually okay. Maybe I need a of 0 to be 0. And somehow this change of variables doesn't fit into all of the standard theories, but nevertheless, one can develop a change of variables series for things that work, which are gradients of convex functions that work in an almost everywhere sense, and allow us to do these kind of computations, which is basically all you need if you want to compute functionals of the along these geodesic paths. So, are there questions? So what I was going to do after the break was talk about displacement convexity. So try to connect these geodesics in this metric space of probability measures to some of the geometric inequalities that I talked about on Thursday. So various kinds of functionals, like say the LP norm for any p bigger than 1, even bigger than 1 minus a little bit, are convex functions of S along these paths that interpolate between pairs of densities, probability densities, and actually that convexity with respect to the interpolation parameter S is one manifestation of isoperimetry. And,
So if I have two sets, so to indicate a function,
yeah,
and interpolate,
No, but you get something which is supported on, so, okay. So this is a very nice case. It's a very nice special case. The case where u naught of x is characteristic function of one set k, and u1 of x is characteristic function of a second set L. And let's even take them to have the same volume, or unit volume, so that these are probability measures. And then what's true, one corollary of the convexity that I just described for the L infinity norm, is that UF will have L infinity norm less than or equal to 1. And the other thing that's true is that because FS, wherever it's gone, because this thing is taking its values in the Minkowski sum of K and L, so you don't get a characteristic function anymore, but because of this combination of information, you do get something that will allow you to estimate the volume of 1 minus Fk plus Fl. It says that because this is not bigger than 1, the volume of this thing can't be too small. Right. In that case, you will. Sure. You'll have, in that case, you'll have an indicator function in the middle, but it will have a different. It won't have one in front of it. It'll have the the volume of the intermediate domain, which is larger than one. But I mean, it's even worse than that. I mean, this is not generally US is not generally going to be constant. Going to have a constant magnitude inside. Yeah, in fact, what's a little bit maybe special about, or I'm not sure, I guess that one is okay. There's also this question about when do you have actually equality here? And I think that maybe in your example you also have strict inequality here. I'm not sure. So I know that in a very degenerate case of your example, for example, I'm not sure about this. What I want to argue is that if you take a very degenerate ellipse and you add it to a circle, that I think that you don't get an ellipse in between. I think that what you get is something more like a hockey rink. But maybe I'm. So if these two sets are both ellipses, this thing will be supported on an ellipse. But I think that this thing will not be an ellipse. And so I think that you can see that there's a strict inequality here also. Unless the ellipses are homothetic or something like that. Right. If they have same axis, you can absolutely write the solution by hand. And if they don't have the same axis, you can also write the solution by hand, but it's a little bit nastier because it involves taking the square root of some unpleasant matrix. I mean, if you have two ellipses, they're usually given by equations like x ax is less than 1 and x dx is x y dy is less than 1 for some symmetric non-negative matrices A and B. If these two guys commute, the map is beautiful. The map is something like y is it's something like d, it's something like a inverse x d, or possibly I have the inverses on the wrong guys. If these guys don't commute, there is also a formula for the optimal map. So in other words, for the convex function I claim is a quadratic form with this matrix here. But the formula is much more unpleasant. It's something like square root of I'm loath to take a stab at it. It has this flavor. There's a couple of b's in and out to some different powers, and then maybe there's an a to the minus 2 here and a b to the 1/2 here and here. And probably that's too many b's, so maybe b to the negative 1/2. It's something of this flavor that I could work out if I spent a little bit of time with it. But it's an awful thing because it's sort of a product of 5 matrices with a matrix square root over the middle 3. And whatever it is, it should reduce to this when they commute with each other, which this one actually seems to almost not quite do. Yeah, so these are very nice special cases. U naught and U one, characteristic functions of ellipses. Implies psi of x is quadratic. Or if both of these things are Gaussians, then psi of x is quadratic. These are almost the only explicit cases that I, non-trivial cases that I know that can be computed explicitly. The other cases are like if U1 is a translative, maybe a translated dilative U0. Other questions? So, we get a drink of water. I take off the microphone.
Thank you. glass of water. Or maybe you want to get a glass of water also. Okay.
Had the paper in my hands this afternoon, but I apparently didn't bring it to class. These technical things form an appendix in some paper, in my thesis. Well, not in my thesis, but in some... They were written in my thesis. They were not an appendix in my thesis, and then they became an appendix when in the publication version. But, so I think this gets stated somewhere here. But I actually, of course, like the way that I stated it better, but...
I assume, yeah.
The proof of this theorem is rather elementary, but a little bit tricky and tedious. So that's, this is the almost everywhere statement. Here's the last thing. Let M be the set of points where this is defined and invertible, which are also Lebesgue points. But I want them to be Lebesgue points
For U naught.
Right. Full measure from U, this is full measure from U.
I can kind of get it. I just need some time. It just takes a while for this stuff to settle in.
Nope.
No, I like this. I like the geodesic.
How do I see that this is actually an ellipse? It follows from this fact. So you have to first check that the optimal map between two characteristic functions of ellipses is actually linear. The gradient of static functions is actually a linear mapping. The image of any ellipse under any linear map is an ellipse.
I I actually didn't know what you're totally saying this before you got thought. Yeah, that makes sense. It's just like, so it's always inside like the kind of the average of K&L.
Exactly.
So like just averaging K&L, just like kind of like it, like a bad way to do it.
K like, lives here and L lives
you
there.
You just bring in, stretch it slowly and put it on. But then the better way is something inside of that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, that's right. Oh, that's like, so we'd start off with K, then it'd squeeze in, then
it morphs. Back. It morphs.
Yeah. L. Yeah. Huh.
So that's a nice idea that actually people picked up in a little bit in the image smoothing world. To use this kind of idea to, you have two images. Maybe you have a very rough film, a very coarse film. So you have snapshots that were taken at like 2 second intervals apart from each other. And you want to create a smoother film so it looks more pleasing to the eye. Exactly. You have two black and white images and you find the optimal map between the intensities of the two images and you use that to smooth the film over so that...
So one way, like, the way that, like, I would have done for a kid, I would just, like, have what, so 1 minus that K plus the XL.
Right.
They actually use all those.
A little bit. People have experimented with it, yeah. People have started to experiment with it. In fact, we had a... Yeah. Well, with this U sub S, these geodesics, so you have a set of discrete snapshots, and you would like to make a film that looks continuous. So you want a way, but if I show you this picture of 1 second, and then this picture of 1 second, and that picture of 1 second, it looks very jerky to you. And so you want a way of smoothly interpolating between the time zero picture and the time one picture, between the time one picture and the time two picture. And so this is one possible way that people have used a little bit. Right. And there were people here in Toronto 2 years ago, in 2001 at the conference we had in the summer, that were doing, so people have tried to do this with medical images also. And remember there was this one guy who had all these computer graphics of the colon fly-through? Yeah, from I can't remember what the name of the teaching hospital is in Boston, yeah. But so that's another application where you're going to do brain surgery to remove a tumor. So you have, well, another problem is you have a very high quality three-dimensional MRI scan that was taken a few weeks ago. And then you now have the patient on the operating table, and if you're in a state-of-the-art, and you open up their head, and everything moves around. And if you're in a state-of-the-art facility, you might be getting a crummy ultrasound image. And you would like to be able to figure out which features on the crummy ultrasound image that you currently see match up with which features on the high-resolution MRI image that was taken 3 weeks ago. What's that? I haven't heard. I haven't really talked to him since that conference 2 years ago. So maybe I'll resume. So actually, I'm just going to flick the lights. I'm going to resume. So actually, since this question got raised, let me say how do I know these things? It's not that bad. So How do I know that the optimal map between two ellipses is linear? How do I know that the optimal map between two Gaussians is linear? So the first observation is that the image of an ellipse under a linear map is an ellipse. And similarly with Gaussians. And so you have to figure out if the ellipse is given by an equation like this. So in fact, if the ellipse is, let's say, the unit ball under some, if the image under some matrix P of the unit ball under some linear map of the unit ball, and then if I hit this with another linear map, then I get a second ellipse over here. Let's call it f of b10, where f is PE. And actually, maybe P was a poor choice. And the question that you have to ask yourself is, suppose I have arbitrary E and lambda. Can I find so E should be positive symmetric matrix. Does there exist P symmetric and positive, such that P of E of the unit ball is the same as lambda of E of the unit ball. And this reduces to some question about matrices. I mean, it's not necessary that P E be lambda E, because, for example, there are lots of linear maps that take the unit ball to itself, namely all of the rotations, and only one of them is symmetric and positive, namely the identity. But this somehow reduces to a question about matrix algebra, to which the answer is yes. And so the answer is actually there exists a unique P positive such that this is true. And what, once you believe this matrix algebra, and the matrix algebra is a little bit, it's basically, if someone writes it down for you and shows you the answer, it's immediate to verify the answer. It's not entirely obvious to guess it, but it amounts to something like this, and four people guessed it independently between 1980 and 1984 in four different contexts. At least two or three of them were statisticians, and one or two of them were, one was an economist maybe, and once you know the answer to this algebra question, then you know that because the optimal mapping between this guy and that guy is unique, and it's uniquely characterized as a gradient of a convex function, if the answer to this algebra question is yes, then you know that it's easy to check that this function is convex by the positivity of P, and that its gradient pushes forward this guy to this guy, and therefore that this is the optimal thing. So that's somehow how the strategy of the proof goes. And it's actually even useful. Yes, Max?
And so the Gaussian is the same thing, right? Because the Gaussian is characterized by
By its covariance matrix, yeah. Okay, so, once you have that this thing is quadratic, then you know that this capital psi of S and X is also quadratic. And so the convex, quadratic. And so the interpolating map F of S is also linear. In fact, it's just this thing. And so that tells you that US is also the characteristic function of an ellipse properly normalized at any intermediate time. Or US, if U and U1 are Gaussians, US is also Gaussian at any intermediate time. And it's actually awful if you read these papers from 1980 to 1984 and you watch the suffering that people go through to get this. They do this horrible exercise in linear algebra with Lagrange multipliers, and you know they're doing a constrained minimization in n-squared variables where they're looking at n by n ellipses. And it's just horrible, that, and you don't need to go through it once you know that as soon as I have a convex function, then whose gradient pushes forward one ellipse to the other, then I have the optimal thing in my hands. So I wanted to, yep. Other questions, corrections, comments? So I wanted to state some theorems and connect them to the isoparametric inequality and at least the Brun-Minkowski inequality, which we showed last class implies the isoparametric problem. So, yes. And maybe before I do that, I should remind you that the Brun-Minkowski inequality was some geometrical inequality that tells you the nth root of the volume of a sum of two sets is bigger than the nth root of the sum of the volumes, or the volume of the sum, whatever, the sum of the nth roots of the volumes. And the analog of this for matrices, for n by n matrices, is that if A and B are m by n matrices, and I, as usual, I want them to be symmetric non-negative, then determinant 1 over n of A plus B is bigger than the nth root of the determinant of A plus the nth root of the determinant of B. And this actually would, I guess, correspond to something. I wanted to say that this would correspond to the case of the ellipses up here, but maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe that's not even true. And the proof of this is the domination of the geometric by the arithmetic mean. So first let A be the identity matrix. Then what I'm asking is on the left, I'm asking for this to be bigger than determinant of 1 over n identity divided by determinant 1 over n identity plus d. This is what I'm asking for. But this is the nth root of the product of 1 over 1 plus bi, where little bi are the eigenvalues of the symmetric non-negative matrix B, plus the product of bi over 1 plus bi. And the domination of the geometric by the arithmetic mean oh, yeah, probably I want this formula. So so the domination of the geometric by the arithmetic mean tells me that this is less than 1 over n times the sum of 1 over 1 plus the eigenvalues plus the domination of the geometric by the arithmetic mean here tells me that this is less than 1 over n times bi. And I can bring those two things together, and this is 1 summed n times. And so that's the desired inequality. And if A is strictly larger than if A is non-negative, then we just checked that determinant 1 over n identity plus a to the minus 1 half b a to the minus 1 half is larger than and multiplying by because the determinant of a product is the product of the determinants, this gives me the desired thing. And if I have this for all strictly positive A, I can add epsilon. I mean, I can add epsilon to it. If I have A bigger than or equal to zero, I have this inequality for any A plus epsilon, and letting epsilon go to zero, I get it for A equal to zero. Okay. So this is the general algebraic fact that underlies the Brun-Minkowski inequality, and I want to talk about it. Also underlies these other inequalities for these that hold along these geodesics in this metric space of probability measures. And so here, let me say what the theorem is. Actually, so I can tell you some heuristic motivation for the theorem as well. But so the theorem says that oh wait, I should give a definition. Geodesically convex. On the length space M. Minimizing geodesic. And so I'm interested in various kinds of convex functionals on my my metric space of probability measures, and so the non-trivial convexity result is that if A satisfies satisfies since it's this mapping here, let's call this U of R is convex non-increasing, then stated in a slightly sloppy way, but anyhow, it's true. It's true in as much generality as you could want it to be true. You might want to insist that these be absolutely continuous measures, so that they really have densities. And you might want to insist that they have second moments, but I actually don't think that really very much is essential. As long as this is defined, then the theorem is true. And you also sometimes want to relax this to be real valued. And then you may need some moment conditions, finite second moments or something, on U in order to make sense, to be sure that the negative part of this integral is not, and the positive part are not simultaneously infinity, so to be sure that the integral is well defined. But let me try to give some insight into this condition, which is so there's one case in which the geodesics are very simple, and that's the case where U1 of X is just a dilation of U naught of X. There are actually many cases where the geodesics are simple, but this is one of them. The hypothesis here is that if this energy is convex along these particular geodesics, and if it's non-increasing, so that in the sense that if U1 is very spread out compared to U0, then it should have a lower energy with respect to this thing, then it's also convex along all of the geodesics in this space here. And I actually think of this, so typical examples are the things that satisfy this hypothesis. Our A of R is equal to R to the mth power over M minus 1, provided M is bigger than 1 minus 1 over the dimension. Probably not everyone can see that. And another non-power law example that is interesting is kind of what happens if you let M since these things are all probability measures, I can subtract a U off of here if I want, and that will only shift E by a constant. And so I could subtract an R here, and that really wouldn't change the function in any essential way. And now if I let M tend to 1, I get a limit of the form 0 over 0, and the limit is actually, L'Hopital's rule tells us that it's something like R log R. So that's sort of M, that's instead of M equals 1. And I will now forget about subtracting this. And so I actually tend to think of this thing as being, I think of U as being the density distribution of a gas throughout Euclidean space, and this energy as being some kind of internal energy that comes from the fact that the gas has a pressure, and so it resists compression. And if I crush it all the way to infinity down to its present location, I do a certain amount of work, PDV. And as long as that pressure is an increasing function of density, I need a little bit more than that. I think I need the pressure over the density to some power is non-decreasing. So this is a slightly stronger assumption that the pressure increases with the density. Then I get an internal energy of this form when I integrate PdV. Okay. So my claim is this is geodesically convex. And it's not hard to check if you believe the what went before. It's what's called the Boltzmann entropy, yes. And that would come, the Boltzmann entropy, so I said very quickly that I think of this as being the internal energy of a gas. And I believe the Boltzmann entropy would come out of the case where the pressure is equal to the density, so the ideal gas law. Then when you integrate PdV, a typical kind of thing is that the pressure is some power of the density. And then it turns out that the A up here is also the same power of the density, but maybe with a different constant in front. And that the constant, unfortunately, goes to zero when the power goes to one, which would be the situation for an ideal gas. But in that case, the A is actually U log U. So let me see. I guess the pressure is related to the A by some differential equation of the following form. I very likely don't have it right, but there's some relationship between the P and the A like this. So convexity of the A is related to non-atomicity of the P. So maybe the equation should be P prime of U equals U A prime prime. So if I differentiated this previous thing, then I would indeed get something much like this. So I probably this is right, actually. Relates pressure, gas pressure, to internal density, internal energy density. Are there other questions? So, the claim is that condition is sufficient for convexity of this. And to check this out, this is at some intermediate time between two n states, I want to compute an integral like this. And so I would like to do this change of variables here. Where US is the geodesic linking U0 to U1. So psi is the convex function such that grad psi of U0 pushes forward, grad psi pushes forward U0 to U1. And so let me rewrite this in the form. Actually, let me put the g in the denominator. Where u is up there, and gs of x is the determinant of 1 minus s identity plus s d2 psi x over u naught of x. The nth power. And I guess I should multiply this by u of x. And this inequality here, this lemma, an alternate expression. So of course, if these things are positive symmetric matrices, then 1 minus SA plus SB is also a positive symmetric matrix. And this lemma says that the determinant of the nth root of 1 minus SA plus the determinant of the nth root of SB is less than the determinant of the nth root of the convex combination, but the nth root of the determinant scales linearly, so let me take out the 1 minus s and the s. And so this, for all s between 0 and 1, because that keeps the matrices positive, so that's an expression of concavity. And so that says that g is a concave function of f for each x. Yep, I have this determinant here.
Yeah.
And I have a 1 over n here and an n here. Maybe I've gone wrong. So what I wanted to do was probably. Okay. Is it right now? But I want to somehow get this to you. So this is that capital U. Was this a U naught? Thanks. It's this capital U composed with GS of X. Does that look better? And so the GS is concave, and the capital U is convex non-increasing. So GS is bigger than G0, G1, and so when I compose with capital U, because it's non-increasing, that reverses an inequality here. And so then I get less than U of G0 of X plus U of G1 of X. And so this integrand is convex as a function of f. And so that's less than or equal to 1 minus s u composed with g naught against u naught plus s you compose with G1 against U1, but up to here we had equalities. So that's 1 minus S, the energy of U0, plus S times the energy of U1. And so that's the advertised convexity. And so let me so let me point out the Brunnen-Kesky inequality as a corollary of this. And I do a special case of Brunnen-Kesky. I do the case where the volume of K equals the volume of L. You can get the general case by scaling. So if you have to scale L up and K down, if you prove this here, if you prove this convexity statement, then, and you have to scale, sorry, it's a disaster. If you manage to prove that the volume 1 over n of 1 minus sk plus sl is convex in S, whenever K and L have the same volume, that implies that the same thing is true even if they don't have the same volume, because by making different choices of S, I can compensate for having to scale K and L. So Brunnen-Kesky with K equals L is actually hiding in all of these inequalities. So in that case, I want to use exactly what we said before. I want to use the fact that I want to choose U0 of X be characteristic function of K, and U1 of X to be characteristic function of L, and then I want to use the fact that US of X is supported in 1 minus SK plus SL, and the convexity that we just discussed says that so the integral of A of US is less than 1 minus S integral of A of U0 plus S integral of A of U1. So this is basically these are 1 on the, so this is basically A of 1 integrated over a set of volume 1 convex combination. And this, for this fellow here, I don't have to integrate over the whole space. I can just integrate over 1 minus SK plus SL. And I guess I want to use probably Jensen's inequality. So let me divide and multiply by this volume here. And then because A is a convex function, if I average a convex function, I get something bigger than if I average its argument. So Jensen's inequality tells me that this is bigger than 1 minus KS plus SL times A of the integral of US over this set averaged. But US is a probability measure. And so the integral over this set is 1, and then when I divide by the volume of the set, I get this. And A is, this thing was supposed to be not only convex, but not also non-increasing. And so that tells me that this thing here must be bigger than or equal to 1 if this is to be less than or equal to A of 1. And so that's the special case of Grinman-Keski inequality. And so we now know that lots of other inequalities are also hiding in this, in the convexity of this function, including for the Boltzmann entropy. We know that things like Gross's logarithmic sublev inequality can be viewed as a convexity, a corollary of the convexity of this, and I don't know, Talleyrand's transportation inequalities and Villani and Otto's HWI inequalities can all be viewed as corollaries of this guy here. So I think I have basically two lectures left, and I thought that what I would talk about in the last two lectures were this Otto's Riemannian gradient flow framework in the context of the porous medium equation. So some of you have probably heard me talk about that before. And a long-time equilibration. But I guess I will also talk about, as a corollary to that, it's easy for me to talk about how do I see the Gross logarithmic sublev inequality as an expression of this convexity of this functional for this particular choice of A, and so on.
What's your A?
My A?
There.
It's this A here in the theorem. It's any A that satisfies the hypothesis. Yeah, that's the point. I mean, it's any A that's, because the only thing I used of A was that it was convex, so that I could take the integral inside. The integral
right,
with respect to a problem.
How did you take the integral inside?
Jensen's inequality. Jensen says that, okay, so if
you just proved it, but I missed it.
I didn't, probably. But if A of X, so this thing says that the A at an average is bigger than the average of the A's, right?
Sure.
Actually, convexity would be this way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's a generalization of this that says A at an integral with respect to a probability measure is less than the integral of A of x with respect to the same probability measure. Right, and this is the probability measure that I'm using. And that's why I had to divide by the volume to make it a probability measure. So this is one of the cornerstones of analysis, and one should learn it in 457.
You haven't...
Not yet, huh? If not 357, and you should certainly learn it in your graduate analysis course.
But in my own class.
Okay.
And I hope you leave me something to talk about. It seems like you're talking all the things that I was going to talk about.
But I will not do the Savary point of view at all. So I will. But you're not going to have that long to talk. Only 30 minutes. 30 minutes, maybe. Or maybe 40 at the outside.
The point, their point of view is basically a full continuous curve.
Yes.
That's the thing. Well, it seems like their assumptions are very weak, so you can deal with Polish spaces.
Yes.
And this begs the question, if you can view at least, because, like, remember that remark that you can project the Wasserstein structure down to where you come from, right? So down to the original shape.
Sure, by taking Dirac masses or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that begs the question whether every Polish metric space can be given sort of this geometrical interpretation that comes from the...
Probably not. Probably not. So how long are you with us?
Sunday.
Okay, because so tonight's not particularly good for me, but Friday night, we could have dinner or do something. Yeah. Okay. Oh well, thank you. Well, no, Cedric is following me, but
I'm sorry.
but at least.
Is it good? There's somebody to. No, it's
very good, and it's I gave it as a reference for everyone. And actually, today I even read the relevant section. So, but of course I didn't. So today, actually, you know, I'm talking about my thesis. So, it's very. It's really, but the thing that I know left well is when you do the oil. So I describe everything in terms of Lagrangian variables, maps where the particles are going.
Yeah.
And there's this thing which I'm familiar with at some level, and I know it at some level. But this last section, the Eulerian point of view, which is really mostly Felix Otto's and Cedric's, so somehow if it was a 3-hour lecture instead of a 2-hour lecture, then this would have been the third hour.
No, really, I would need to learn more about that, because this is becoming more and more important in TV.
Good.
Maybe you heard about this guy, Perelman.
Of course I heard about Perelman.
So
I've heard rumors that this is connected, but I don't know whether that's just publicity or if there's any actual...
Conjecture.
What?
With Pongrace
conjecture. No.
Yeah, that's the point.
What's the point?
That's what he did. So this Ricci flow is not a gradient flow.
Yes.
He gave a nice formulation with some kind of... He chose kind of gauge for the equation and made it a more or less a gradient flow. And so his main estimate somehow comes down to a logarithmic subvolatile inequality.
Fantastic.
So it's really fantastic.
How do you know this?
So
I can think two possible answers to this question. One possible answer is that you're actually working on geometrical flows yourself.
No.
And the other answer is that you were at this Oberwolfach meeting where Klaus Ecker and Gerhard Huiskin gave a 3-hour review of Perelman's work.
Well, before, so I'm